Oyez, 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 the Honorable Court of Appeals for the Third District of the State of Texas, sitting in Austin, is now in session.
Y'all may be seated. Good afternoon. I'm Gisella Triana. I'm the Senior Justice on the Third Court of Appeals, and I am happy to welcome you to the Third Court. Here, sitting with me, joining me today, is Justice Lopez Theofanis and Justice Crump, who are happy that you are here with us today. A couple of housekeeping for matters before we call the case. We are being live streamed on our YouTube channel right now, and it will be on our website. Anybody else, you know, you don't get enough today and you want to go ahead and see yourself, you can go ahead and pull it up later. I've been told that we're splitting the time. I think it's 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and then 5 minutes, correct?
Yes.
Okay. I'll ask you to please pay attention to the little lights. Green is you're good to go. Yellow means you've got about 2 minutes, and red means stop. Obviously, if you're in the middle of a thought or sentence, I don't expect you to stop. But if it's going to take more than just finishing that up, I'd request for you to ask. I will tell you, in cases, sometimes we'll have more questions than what you're ready for, and so we're always happy to give you a little more time to answer those as well. So at this time, I am going to go ahead and call the case, and this is 03-23-459-CV, Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance versus the Texas Department of Agriculture, and Sid Miller in his official capacity as commissioner. If I could go ahead and first of all, are the parties ready to proceed? Is the appellant ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
And
yes,
is the appellee ready? Would you please make your announcements by stating your name on the record as well as who you represent?
Carly Martin, on behalf of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance.
And James Frizzell, the Office of the Attorney General, on behalf of the Texas Department of Agriculture.
Thank you both. Okay, then if you're ready to proceed, Ms. Barton, you want to join us up here?
May it please the court.
Counsel.
My name is Carly Barton, and I'm here today representing the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance in their challenge to the Texas Department of Agriculture's flawed interpretation and implementation of the federal produce safety rule. At stake in today's case is overreaching government regulation into the lives and livelihoods of small farmers and ranchers throughout the state of Texas. Today, I'm going to first address why TDA cannot expand its powers beyond that of the produce safety rule. Second, that during the rulemaking process, TDA violated the Administrative Procedures Act. And lastly, I'll address the how TDA's rules violate the Fourth Amendment protections under the United States and Texas constitutions. Before we get too far into those, I would like to set a little bit of a picture of how we got here and talking about produce safety rules. Federal Congress passed the Food Safety Modernization Act in 2011. This was the first time that harvesters and producers in the United States had science-based standards and regulations that they would have to adhere to prevent outbreaks such as the E. coli or listeria outbreaks that we saw during that time. After they passed the Food Safety Modernization Act, then of course they went through their own regulation and rulemaking where they created the Produce Safety Rule, which is Title 21 Code of Federal Regulation Part 112, which is what we are here to talk about today. As part of adopting this federal regulatory framework, Texas decided that it was going to become a PATHC state. And what a PATHC state means is that they were able to enter into a cooperative agreement with the federal government in order to conduct their own produce safety inspections under their own authority. Many states under this authority and other PATHC states took that as in they are going to not only do what the federal government had guided them to, but also empower their states to regulate produce safety in general. However, that's not the case what happened in Texas. Texas passed the Texas Agricultural Code Section 91.009, and in that, it directly ties the state's authority for produce safety regulation to that federal regulatory code, the Produce Safety Rule, that Part 112.
But let me ask you, because Section 9109 specifically states, "The department may adopt rules to administer, implement, and enforce this section. In development of rules under this section, the department may consider relevant state, federal, and national standards, and may consult with federal or state agencies." So what authority supports your contention that the department can't impose anything that's more stringent than the federal rules?
I would point you to the subsection A of that code, where it states that we are going to be implementing what is section 112. And then the subsection that you are pointing to, yes, they can look to other states, other federal regulations as guidance, as examples of what they might be wanting to implement in Texas. However, their grant of authority is ultimately tied to what is in CFR 112. Now, the plain language of the federal rule provides that certain farms are not covered under the produce safety rule. Those are ones with less than $25,000 of selling produce in the state. Another important distinction is that there's also a qualified exempt status that a small farm can have, and that if it makes less than $500,000 or sells less than $500,000 worth of produce over a three-year rolling period, that they do not have to adhere to these restrictions. And that is because they can be quite onerous, they can be quite time-consuming and can cost money, and because the risk is not there for a small farm and ranch. So they were exempted at the federal level, and they were not covered at the federal level. And because of that, the state of Texas has to adhere to that that non-coverage and that qualified exempt as well.
On that topic, Council, you've represented that there's a certain number for a cost of compliance with the law, and your friend across the aisle doesn't agree with that number. Where do you derive the number that you suggest?
Yes, the cost of compliance is in a study done by the, in our appendix, in our record, that was completed by, I believe, the USDA. It's on page 600 of the record, and it details those costs of compliance for all sorts of, at the highest level, but also for even a small, an exempt farm or a non-covered farm, and that they would, that it does cost money for these small farms to be in compliance. Additionally, really where the crux of this issue comes down to is, what is an inspection? These, whether you're a non-covered farm or a qualified exempt farm, is all about money. It is all about what is the financial situation of your small farm. TDA has taken the position that an inspection means an on-site, in-person inspection, and that they can come out to these, in fact, they require coming out to these properties to see it in person, to get on the ground and look at it as part of an inspection. However, this is contrary to how the federal regulators have interpreted this. It's contrary to what the statute says, which is that if you are, for example, a qualified exempt farm, you are only supposed to, you have some record keeping rules that you must follow, right? You have to have a certain amount of records. You have some labeling requirements so that when a consumer goes out and sees, okay, my, you know, this is where my meat's from, this is where my produce is from. However, they do not have to follow the all the other rules in that part. And now that...
Is it the Alliance's position that they don't have any power to come and inspect, not even for safety reasons, that because they are either exempted or non-covered, that physical inspection is just out of the question?
Physical inspection is out of the question in order to determine a qualified exempt status, okay, or a not covered or a coverage status.
As to that?
Yes.
Okay.
As to that. We're not trying to take away their power to come in if there is some sort of biohazardous situation going on. However, they've been exempted. They are not covered because they aren't great risk. They're not a great risk that these regulations are trying to address. In this idea of the inspection, there is no need for a physical inspection because these are all record keeping. These are all fall under that. And I would also say, Justice Triana, that the non-covered farms, if you are 25,000 or less, they're not supposed to get inspected, period. And that's consistent with what the federal regulators have issued, is that because they are not covered, they are not regulated by that statute.
Not inspected for purposes of whether they're exempt or non-covered, correct? Or are you saying that if you're under 25,000, then you should not be, you know, if there's a concern about E. coli or any kind of safety, you should not be able to be?
Federal guidance tells us that if it is under the produce safety rule, if they are not covered farm, they say no inspection. Now, if there is a complaint or if there's information out there that there could be a situation where there is a safety hazard, yes, they could go on there with their police authority. But however, that's not what's contemplated in 112, nor that's what the guidance from the federal government states as well. So in addition, this kind of goes into this idea of what the inspection is and what is the scope of that inspection. When the federal government has released their guidance about what this first inspection should be on a qualified exempt or on a non-covered farm, they're saying it's a phone call, it's documentation, and if you say you've got it and we are confirmed that we understand and we know what your amount is, then you're to move on. There is no in-person inspection after that. In contrast, TDA is saying, yes, we have to be on the ground. And if you refuse an on-ground inspection under the TAC, they say, well, we can fine you for $500 a day for not letting me inspect your property and your small farm. Even if you are qualified exempt, even if you aren't covered, because of the way they have defined inspection in this statute. So, under the broad description, really what we are concerned about is that this regulation is tied to what the federal government has passed, that the statutory authority that the Texas legislature have given to TDA is tied to the federal regulation. And that's not a narrow interpretation. That is the strict text of the code itself. And while the Texas Department of Agriculture has had the ability to educate and outreach about produce safety, this passage of 91.009 was the first time they were given an enforcement mechanism, and that there were actually these regulations out there that they could levy a fine or a penalty or stop sell order. So this is certainly different than what they had what they had prior to the passage of this and prior to the passage of the Food Safety Modernization Act and the Produce Safety Rule after. To my second point, that TDA failed to provide reasoned justification under the Administrative Procedures Act. In order to adopt a rule, an agency must provide public notice, opportunity for full and consideration of comments, and a reasoned justification for the rule. This is under Texas Government Code. This is under McCarty versus Texas Parks and Wildlife, and has been adopted by the courts many times. We can see in the record on pages 601 through 615, Ms. Judith McCreary, who is the executive director of FARFA, who's here today, submitted a detailed letter about all of her concerns, 15 pages or 12 pages of how they felt that this regulation was not lining up with the intent, the spirit, or the text of CFR 112. And in response to these very detailed legal arguments, we can see in the Texas Register that they are summarily dismissed with one-line responses, or even just saying, ditto whatever this person said. It's the same question, when clearly it was not the same question. So if we looked at the page 562 of the record, We have those comments in the federal or in the Texas Register, where the Texas Organic Farmer and Growers Association talk about their concerns on the right of entry section that they're trying to pass, specifically subsection B, and that qualified exempt farms should not be subject to entry for inspections because they are qualified and exempt. So TDA ultimately addresses that comment, but when they are addressing FARFA's comments, which are about all of section 11.40, not just subsection B, and assert that this particular statute is ambiguous and overbroad and goes through many reasons why, the response from TDA is, see our response from the Organic Farmer and Growers Association, when a completely different argument was being made as to why that the problems with that particular regulation and that particular comment. So TDA did not properly respond and not give the reason justification that they are supposed to be giving to the comments and addressing in this rule. TDA's responsible response in the Texas Register to why they can go on a right of why they can use the right of entry on a qualified exempt, and their own response is, well, we just gave ourselves that power in the definitions part in section one, which doesn't really make much sense. You have the right to do right of entry on a farm because I gave myself that right in the same statutory scheme that I'm trying to pass through. So it's quite illogical.
What do you make of their argument that to prohibit right of entry would lead to absurd results?
I don't think it's going to lead to these absurd results because they are still able to, on a complaint or with information, they are still able to regulate and to go and investigate whether there is a violation of the produce safety rules. But they are not allowed to just do that because they want to do their record keeping, right? Or because they want to make sure that you're qualified exempt still. Again, it's just this weird interpretation of what is an inspection. To them, an inspection is on site, in person, every single time. Whereas if a farm is not covered and if a farm is not qualified exempt, you can't just go on their property because you feel like it. Because though they are exempt, they're not supposed to be following these regulations, so why do you get to go on their property when they are exempt from the regulations? So I don't think it would lead to an absurd result. And if it is an absurd result, it's an absurd result that the federal government has set out, because these farms are not the risky part. These are not the risky farms that lead to E. coli breakouts, and they were not the parts that were targeted for this regulatory structure. And that's with the Tester Amendment. That's what was argued when the act was passed in Congress as well.
I've got one last question, which is under your Fourth Amendment claim. Y'all are claiming, Legions is claiming that egregious condition is unconstitutionally vague. How can it be vague? I mean, the FDA uses it as well. Are y'all claiming that it's also under the federal regulations unconstitutionally vague, or what would it mean? Why would it be unconstitutionally vague under the TDA but not the FDA?
So the FDA does use egregious condition, but then they have 4 pages of explanation of what they think an egregious condition is and what are the things that could actually apply to it. In this case, there's nothing. There are 2 subsections with no explanation or guidance as to what that might be. If you look at other states, they did give guidance in their statutes and in their regulations stating, oh, it can be, maybe it's exposure to fecal matter, maybe it's putting the horses too close to the produce. They give certain examples to really narrow and make sure that you understand what an egregious condition is versus what Texas has done that would invite this kind of arbitrary or discriminatory way, depending on which inspector you would get.
Okay. Anything else? Thank you, Ms. Martin.
Thank you.
Mr. Brazel?
Your Honors, thank you for the opportunity to argue this case today. I may start backwards, or start at the end and go back to the beginning to address some of these arguments. And I had an introduction prepared, but I think I'm going to have to just leave it for a little bit later if we have time. With regard to the egregious condition question that you asked, the last question you had, the measure of whether or not it's vague has nothing to do with whether or not there are extra or a certain number of examples that are given. It's whether or not the words themselves are comprehensible and whether or not they tie back to the act or to the rule that's being applied. And in this case, first of all, the term egregious is defined in the record to being, and sorry to put it so simply, but it means very bad and very noticeable. I mean, it's a simple thing that, you know, everybody kind of understands. The conditions that are talked about are the conditions that are in the federal rule, the FDA's rules. The FDA's rules are set out in a particular way, essentially in three sections. The first section is subsections A through D are the administrative sections. A through C are the administrative sections. And then D through K or L, those are the standard sections, the substantive sections. Those are the ones that talk about contamination, how to prevent contamination, and they're broken down into six categories, and I don't need to name them all, but the categories include hygiene, animals, agricultural water. Those are all the substantive provisions that govern that are part of this rule, the rule that the state is now enforcing. Egregious conditions are conditions that relate to those conditions, conditions that relate to animals, conditions that relate to sewage, conditions that relate to waste, conditions that relate to water. All of the things that are in the rule are the conditions that are being discussed and egregious.
Did you study the other states' similar regulations to determine whether or not there's overlap or these different conditions that are set forth separately that don't overlap?
No, I think the conditions are similar and very similar, and there is overlap. And there are two other things I want to be sure and mention. One of them is the egregious condition language and the definition in our rule is exactly or directly from section 112 or part 112, section 11, 112.11. It tracks that exact language. Therefore, it's applying, the rule doesn't use the term egregious condition, but it uses all the remaining terminology that describes the problem, the egregiousness of the circumstances. In addition, the Texas Department of Agriculture has an inspection manual that we included in our exhibit filing toward the end. And it, like the FDA's inspection manual, which we also put in that filing, includes examples of egregious conditions. So the egregious conditions are being included in the regulatory program, but without any need for an extra long list of examples. It's understood that there are many kinds of egregious conditions, but they don't all need to be spelled out for an individual that's applying this to be able to understand what it is. That's the first issue.
I'm sorry. Just on a jurisdictional big picture issue, will you address ripeness? Because I don't think it's specifically addressed in your briefing.
Right. Ripeness was an issue that was litigated below, and it had to do with whether or not anybody had been harmed by these rules at the time of the litigation. We've come a kind of a long way since then, and so the chances that there may have been some instances of harm that we're not aware of, the chances that maybe some of the farmers have actually encountered issues, there may actually be.
Okay, so you're not arguing today that the claims are not ripe?
We are not arguing ripeness at all.
Okay.
We're just leaving that out.
Okay, thank you.
So thank you for asking that, though. With regard to the claims regarding the the rulemaking, the APA rulemaking, that's what I need to discuss. Your Honors, the farmers are completely incorrect about this, and the reason is the rules that apply to rulemaking and that relate to
reason justification.
I'm sorry, just yeah. The reason justification, I'm sorry, that's what I'm trying to get at. Thank you very much. The rules that relate to a reason to evaluating a reason justification and whether or not there has been one, first of all, there does not have to be, the rule has to be, the reason justification has to be evaluated from the four corners of the document. It has to be determined whether or not the agency they have to state their factual basis for the rules. The reasons have to state why the agency disagrees with party submissions, but there doesn't have to be any particular level of robustness or voluminousness to those responses. All that's required is that the agency state whether it agrees or not, and if possible, the reasons for it. It's even acceptable for there to be just simply a denial or a rejection. We just reject this is enough to meet the reason justification test. In this instance, all of those have been met. The agency gave notice, it received comments, it put all the comments in the preamble to the rule, it explained the basis for the rule in the preamble, and then it listed all of the comments and then gave responses. One set was short and also, as complained of, was included by referring to an answer in a previous question. There's no reason that can't be a proper answer. But the main thing about that is there is no requirement. If the answer to both questions is the same, which it is, the answer is substantively and legally the same answer to both questions. One, is it arbitrary, or another, is it sufficient? I mean, if the answer is still no, it's we reject the request, and there an inspection is required, and therefore we have to go ahead and conduct that inspection, then the same answer can be given for both questions, even if they're not the same question. There's no requirement that every single question have its own unique answer. And it's common for agencies to refer to other answers to other questions or answers to other questions in answering a question. This agency's adoption of the rule met all the requirements for the APA reason justification, and the complaint is unfounded. Now, as far as back to the issue of the inspections, the farmers and ranchers have got it all wrong as far as the inspections. First of all, they've used the wrong term for the wrong activities. Inspections are the process of, they are a fairly robust procedure where there's an entry into property, in this case with permission from the farmers, and where there's a routine that's pursued to determine whether or not the rule is being complied with. There is another kind of visit that's for a totally separate reason, and that's to determine yes or no, are these farmers covered or are they not covered? Are they small enough that they're not covered, or are they big enough that they are covered?
But why can't that be done through verification of financial records? I mean, what is the justification for an in-person inspection, whatever we want to call it, to verify the exempt status or make sure they're not covered?
And there's about three answers to that. The first one is that the agency and its expertise, based on its judgment and experience, has determined that for them to know which farm they're talking about and be sure they're talking about the right farm and the right farmers, that they need to actually see it. They need to actually meet them. But let me be clear. There is not an investigation. I'm sorry. There is not an inspection being conducted to enter the farm. They can meet at the gate and have a talk, have a discussion. As far as asking for documents, they're not even asking for documents. They're just having a discussion. How much did you make last time? One of the reasons, though, that they need to actually be there is because they need to be able to discuss what's going on at the farm to understand whether or not you even have covered produce, because one of the elements of being a covered farm is that you're engaging in the growth of covered produce. So that inquiry is not an inspection. And it is correct that there are no regular inspections ever conducted on the smallest group of farmers, the not covered group of farmers, the $25,000 and under. They never get inspections of any kind, no matter what. Inspections. They will get a visit for the determination to be made of whether or not they are covered or not covered.
And y'all's position is that that doesn't even have to be on the premises, that it could be literally...
It could be right there at the gate of the farm.
Okay.
But it does need to be made because in the rule, the terms for determining whether or not a farmer is or a farm is covered or not covered, they're included in the rule in sections 112.4 for not covered farmers, or it also actually describes covered farmers and then as a result identifies the not covered farmers. 112.5 is for qualified exempt farmers. It sets out how they qualify. 112.6 talks about records that relate to qualified exempt farmers. 112.7, and then the remainder, some of the other sections of the rules relate to the qualified exempt farmers. The because there is a definition and standards for determining whether a farm is qualified or not qualified, not covered or covered, or has a qualified exemption, because there are standards in this rule, the agency has to make a determination. They can't just decide it in a vacuum, and they can't only let someone call them up and tell them I'm a covered farm. They need to make a determination that satisfies the rule whether or not the farm is covered, not covered, or qualified exempt.
So can you walk me through the process of how this would look, this inspection or whatever we're going to call it? Does the farmer have a right to have notice?
The farmer would receive notice from the agency and
advance notice.
Yes, and the agency would ask for them to meet them wherever the farmer chooses. The farmer could choose to be at the gate. Farmer could invite them up to the house for coffee. I mean, whatever they want to do. There is no search and seizure going on here. And again, Justice Triana, that inquiry would not be an inspection. An inspection is this much more robust process that reviews the farm in greater detail. This is just an on-site visit. This is just a visit to meet with the farmer to determine whether or not they are covered
or not covered. Could that happen in y'all's office?
I'm sorry?
Could that happen in your office?
Could it happen?
Not in your office, but Sid Miller's office, I don't know. And I mean, is the point, I think you have said, they want to put eyes on the farmer, they want to put eyes on the farm. So is the department saying, no, we want to be there, or could it be just as simple as, you know, come over and answer some questions?
I'm not sure I have quite understand your question yet. Come over and...
You're telling me that it could be at the gate.
Right.
Can it be at a restaurant? Can it be somewhere other than the farm?
No. I mean, the agency has determined based on its expertise, its experience dealing with a lot of farmers and a lot of ranchers over the years, that they need to actually see the farm. And if you think about it, Justice Triana, that makes sense, because we're talking about an activity that's engaged in real estate in some form or fashion. And one of the most fundamental concepts of real estate is you need to know which piece of property you're actually talking about. You could imagine a situation where there's a phone call and a description and there's a lack of understanding between the parties over the phone, and the agency is left with the impression that the farm that's at issue is one that's next door or down the road. This is an issue that has to do with growing crops. It's an issue that has to do with a requirement for safety for something that can be very, very dangerous and very costly if not handled. And it's enforcing or applying, administering, really, these criteria that are included in the rule, the FDA's rule. The FDA created the divisions that the farmers fall in, and the Texas Department of Agriculture has determined that the way we need to apply this to determine whether they're covered or not covered is to ask them to meet with us, go talk to them, have an exchange, And then we can either tell them right there or get back to them and let them know if they're covered. If they are not covered, they are not covered, and that's the end of it. And there are no further inspections. There are no interruptions because of egregious conditions, nothing along that nature. Although, with one caveat, the determination of whether or not they're covered or not covered, qualified, exempt or not, is made on a rolling three-year average. If you're using a rolling three-year average, you're going to, every year, the data is going to change. Every year, one year will fall off and a new year will come on if you're using a rolling three-year average. So as you go forward in time, the numbers may change and there may be another need
but,
for...
But to Justice Triana's prior question, couldn't you do that piece? This three-year review is really just numbers,
it's,
correct?
Yes, possible, because then what you've got is a situation where you've got a farmer who you already know is not covered. If the numbers still support it, you already know where the farm is. You know what they're doing. So yes, I think that could absolutely work in that way. Now with the qualified exempt, it's a different situation. They actually have legal requirements in the rule for their information to be maintained and reviewed.
When the pre-assessment review is conducted, could egregious conditions be found?
They could be found, but if they're found, nothing will be done by the agency or the department. They'll just have to refer it to the FDA, and the FDA will have to deal with it. Because
I mean, not to go to my little past criminal experience. So is it like, you know, plain and obvious? You're saying no. Let's say we're meeting at the gate. We're having a conversation at the gate. I'm giving you, you're looking at my farm and you see something.
Mm-hmm.
50 yards down that seems like it might be an egregious condition. It might be something that you need to, you do not have the right to go over there and check it out?
If it is a not covered smallest of the small farms, no,
okay.
You don't. The inspection, the right of inspection and of entry is only available for qualified exempts, which, by the way, in the rules, they're defined as covered, but then they're eligible for an exemption.
Correct.
And by the way, just to answer a quick question about one of the claims, there was some concern about whether or not the pre-assessment review issue is vague or doesn't make sense. What's the pre part? What's being assessed? Well, what's being assessed is that the qualified exempt farmers, they don't have an automatic right to the exemption. They have an eligibility for the exemption. So the pre-assessment is the assessment of whether or not that eligibility should turn into a right, whether or not, in fact, they meet the qualifications. So, and that's consistent with and follows the rule. Although it's not set out in the rule, it's necessarily implied and consistent with the terms that are in the rule. Your Honors, I think... I don't know how far along I am, but I think one of the things I wanted to be sure and say is that this is about foodborne illness. This is about a very dangerous and very costly thing. I mean, the record reflects that each year in this country, 48 million people get sick from foodborne illness, 128,000 are hospitalized, and 3,000 die every year from foodborne illness. In the past, the foodborne illness process didn't work all that great or all that well, and we were always catching up or playing catch up or coming in from behind. Congress, the FDA, Texas, the legislature, and other states have entered into this joint effort to implement a new and what they think is revolutionary system, where instead of waiting for foodborne illness to cause problems, they have scientific procedures and standards which are in the rule, in those chapters of the rule that I was mentioning, that they are required to be applied to stop it before it happens. That's what this rule is about. That's what this agency is doing. They are participating in that process. The rules that we are looking at today are not farm rules. It seems like they are, but they're not. They're food rules. They're about food, and they're about maintaining food that is not adulterated, not contaminated, and it's safe. Looks like I'm almost out of time. I'd be glad to answer any additional questions. I've got other issues, but looks like we're almost at the end.
Thank you.
Okay.
Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Mr. Purcell. You may have a seat. Ms. Barton, If you want to come up, and I'm going to ask you, along with whatever it is that you want to respond to or say, I would want to hear what the Alliance's position is on this. Not an inspection. They can just come and talk to us at the gate.
Yes, Your Honor, I would like to talk about that too. So, first off, I think we have to look at what TDA actually passed in their regs. And what their regs say is that an inspection is an initial or follow-up inspection conducted by TOPS for the purpose of inspecting covered produce, a covered farm, or records related to the produce safety rule. So that is what they're defining as an inspection. Then they also give them the right, themselves the right for a right of entry to go into a farm to determine whether it is covered or not covered, and to verify exemptions to the produce safety rule. So they do have that power, and we know that they are using it for non-covered farms because we have that in the record. We have communications with small farmers who have done $5,000 worth of produce sales and say, hey, I think I'm not covered by this. And then their outreach specialist is going out there saying, no, I've got to see it. I got to be out there. I got to go there. They're not meeting at the gate. They're going onto these farms, and sometimes they're even going onto those farms without notice, just because they're in the area and they're trying to cover cover ground and get out to these farms. So, and that is in our appendix. You can see it's page 694 through an appendix, and then it's in our appendix where we have these interactions with these. With these outreach specialists. And I think what's really important to note is that while the department is taking the position that there is a difference between what we're doing at the beginning, just determining coverage, determining exemptions, things like that, there's not that distinction in their actual regs. And that pre-assessment review doesn't have a definition. It just says, okay, we're going to look at this beforehand, but then their policy is to go in person and do an inspection. And when they do this inspection, and I do say inspection because that's what they call it, their own department calls it that, even when it is someone who's not supposed to be covered, who's not supposed to be inspected, because these rules don't apply to them. And that's what Mr. Brazel just stated to you. But we know that that's not happening. We know that they're going beyond their scope and going beyond what their own regs say. But I would like to point out, very importantly, is that while certainly a point of this produce safety rule and the program that they've set up is for education and outreach is something that someone voluntarily does. It is not something that where someone shows up at your gate and says, I went on your property, I'm gonna keep coming, I went on your property to see what's going on there. That's a completely different situation. Education and outreach don't have penalty matrices, like that's what's in here. That if you say, no, I don't want an inspection, and you say no to them, they'll fine you $500. And I understand that maybe that may not be happening in every single instance. That might not even be the intent of TDA, but it is certainly what's in these regs. They certainly have the power to. And that is not what has been allowed in the Code of Federal Regulation. That is the enabling legislation to the enabling legislation to the Texas regs. And so that is why they are confined to that and that they shouldn't be doing that.
Without that type of power, however, how would the department determine whether someone was improperly categorizing themselves as exempt?
On the exemption, there is a very strict statutory provision in the CFR about how a qualified exemption can be removed. So they certainly do have the power to remove a qualified exemption if they see something that is concerning on that property. And we're not trying to take that away from TDA, but we are trying to use inspection, it's defined in the TAC, but they're using it in a different, they're using it in a different way. They're saying, oh, well, an inspection's a really big deal. We got to go out there. We, you know, we're in there for enforcement. But it's really happening pre-enforcement, pre-assessment, before, you know, education and outreach. That's just not what's happening.
Anything else?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much.
Ms. Barton. At this time, cause number 323459CV, Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance versus the Texas Department of Agriculture and Sid Miller in his official capacity as commissioner is submitted. Thank you all very much. The court will stand in recess.